Balancing hormones literally means that if we have identified that the natural fluctuations, the natural hormone environment, the fluctuations within it are a factor in triggering migraine, and particularly as those fluctuations become more variable in women getting to perimenopause, the aim is then to try and literally balance those hormones out. So provide a more stable hormone environment.
Hormones are a part of everyone's life, but even when there's nothing wrong with our hormones, they can act like a wrecking ball on our migraine condition. To complicate matters further, our hormones change drastically at different stages of our life. How do we know if balancing our hormones would be a benefit to our migraine condition? What does that mean, and how is it done? Here to answer some of our common questions and concerns is Dr. Anne McGregor. Dr. McGregor, welcome back to the Migraine World Summit.
Thank you very much for asking me.
So there's tremendous interest in this topic, and as you'll hear, a lot of questions from our Migraine World Summit community. So let's dive in, starting with perimenopause. A lot of women share that their migraine condition worsens, sometimes dramatically so, during perimenopause. Why is this?
Very simple answer. It's as women approach perimenopause, their hormones change from the, much more stable levels, if you like, that we've had through our natural reproductive years. So by the time we get to beginning of perimenopause, usually in early 40s, then we start to get a little bit of hormone chaos going on. So that in particular, the estrogen levels start to fluctuate considerably, and women will only produce the other female hormone progesterone if they ovulate, and ovulation becomes less and less frequent as we approach menopause.
And what is the role then of those hormones in migraine?
So with respect to hormones and migraine, and particularly with respect to what we see with menstrual migraine, we see that the natural fall, the drop in estrogen in particular, that is around the period time, can trigger off migraine with aura. And very high levels of estrogen have been associated with triggering migraine aura. So if we're thinking about this hormone chaos and women are spiking higher levels of estrogen at some times of the menstrual cycle, they might experience attacks of migraine with aura or just migraine aura on its own. And as they're heading towards their period or around their period time, perimenstrually, because of the higher estrogen levels, there's a bigger drop as a natural part of the menstrual cycle. And that drop we know is associated with triggering migraine without aura.
So, hormonally influenced migraine attacks are not just those that happen right before menstruation, but actually at various points then during the cycle.
Potentially, yes. So the trigger for migraine aura is likely to be at the highest points of estrogen across the menstrual cycle. So that's usually around mid-cycle, around the time that a woman is ovulating. And certainly in some of my patients who experience, the two different types of migraine, they will report that the aura is more likely to occur during within the middle of the menstrual cycle, if you like, rather than the migraine without aura that is around the time of their periods. But I do think it's important to also add in at this stage that it's not just directly the sex hormones that are involved in migraine during perimenopause. Women also experience a lot of menstrual disorders as well. And we're also aware that heavy menstrual bleeding, so women who are experiencing very heavy periods and often very painful cramps, which becomes another problem during perimenopause, that's associated with an increased release of another hormone called prostaglandin. And totally independently, prostaglandin release is also associated with a menstrual migraine trigger.
What does balancing hormones actually mean? And is this the same as HRT, MRT, or hormone therapy, as we may hear it in various areas of the world?
Yes. So balancing hormones literally means that if we have identified that the natural fluctuations, the natural hormone environment, the fluctuations within it are a factor in triggering migraine, and particularly as those fluctuations become more variable in women getting to perimenopause, the aim is then to try and literally balance those hormones out. So provide a more stable hormone environment rather than the fluctuating hormone environment. Now, perimenopause is probably the most difficult time to balance the hormones out, because if we're trying to achieve that with hormone therapy, using hormones that are very similar to the natural menstrual cycle hormones, so hormone replacement therapy or menopause hormone therapy, whichever it is in whichever country you're listening from, then these do not override a woman's own natural menstrual cycle. So one has to be very careful in perimenopause versus postmenopause not to add further fluctuations. So while adding back replacement hormones, if you like, will help the troughs, the dips in the natural hormone changes, it may also then be adding an extra peak to the natural hormones. So it can sometimes, if we get it wrong, create more hormone chaos. And I'm sure many of your listeners will have tried HRT during perimenopause and actually found that it's made their migraines worse. And that's the reason why we're generating a further problem. And in those situations, to balance out the hormones, it may sometimes be necessary to actually switch the natural menstrual cycle off, to put the ovaries into hibernation temporarily and replace those hormones with more stable, non-fluctuating hormones. And for those women for whom it's suitable, that can be something like combined hormonal contraception. And we can use that to tide women, if you like, across that menopause transition, so that when they stop the hormone therapy that we've given, whichever type it is, then they're left with their own natural hormones back to becoming more balanced in a post-menopause environment, as opposed to the high fluctuations of perimenopause, if that hopefully will make sense.
Absolutely. And so this really takes a long-term approach, it sounds like, because if you're trying to replicate the peaks and valleys of the menstrual cycle, well, that can't last in perpetuity, but that you're trying to move forward to a steady state that could match what the body produces at some point naturally on its own. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, we're actually trying to override all the natural menstrual cycle changes. So even if we're thinking that the natural menstrual cycle, everybody or many people are concerned about natural hormones and wanting to do everything naturally. And that is absolutely valid. And I run with that all of the time, except when our natural hormones are not playing the right game and they're working against us rather than for us. And then we have to think about the balance for each individual as to what is the most appropriate approach for them. So it's not so much of trying to mimic or recreate what the natural menstrual cycle is doing. It's actually trying to override what the natural menstrual cycle is doing and remove any fluctuation, even that would be natural in response to, you know, for example, the natural falling levels of hormones that then generate a menstrual period. let's get rid of the menstrual period, let's get rid of ovulation, let's get rid of any of the hormone fluctuations in a reversible fashion that is in control of the individual who is using the hormones and in a safe way for that individual, because it's not ever any of the hormones that are necessarily dangerous. It's the woman who takes and who has the issues that may then generate the risk.
I see. So that brings us to a great question of safety, which I think you've just answered beautifully, that this can be safe, that the approaches, the medications, the hormones themselves are safe. It's about how that combines in a particular woman. Is that correct?
That's correct. And I think at this point, it's important to separate out hormone replacement therapy, HRT or MHT, as being very different from the contraceptive hormones that we use to put the ovaries into hibernation. So with the hormone replacement therapy, MHT, HRT, what we're doing there is often using, or nearly always, certainly in the UK, we use body identical estrogen, so it's structurally identical to the estrogen from a woman's own ovaries. And the second hormone that's necessary to protect the lining of the womb from excess estrogen, we will either use a body identical progesterone, or sometimes we'll need to use synthetic progestogens, because they are, for some women, better than the body identical progesterone. And those do not carry any risks really over and above what a woman's own natural menstrual cycle would be doing. Now, that's quite different from the contraceptive hormones, the majority of which use a synthetic estrogen, ethinyl estradiol, together with a synthetic progestogen, that are used to suppress the release of the egg every month, suppress ovulation, and to essentially put the ovaries into hibernation. Whereas the MHT allows the natural menstrual cycle and ovulation, whatever the natural body is going to do, that still occurs. So with the contraceptive estrogens, they are shutting everything down. Now, in contrast to the body identical HRT estrogens, the synthetic estrogens in themselves carry an increased risk of ischemic stroke. So they make your blood more sticky. Now, we talk about numbers, we talk about a twofold increased risk associated with using these hormones, but one has to put that into context, that for the majority of women, they are not at an increased risk of stroke. And for women who have a minuscule risk of ischemic stroke, adding, doubling that risk remains a minuscule increased risk of ischemic stroke. And the benefits may well outweigh any of that risk. So, for example, combined contraceptive hormones will protect you against ovarian cancer. They'll protect you against cancer of the lining of the womb. They'll protect you against colorectal cancer. But you balance this against the potential increased stickiness of the blood. And for women who have migraine aura, in young women, so under age 45, migraine aura in itself doubles the risk of ischemic stroke. And the reason why that is increased risk in young women and not in older women is that older women, we start to develop more obvious other risk factors for stroke, such as diabetes, hypertension, obesity. All of those other factors come into play. But in younger women, it seems that migraine aura and contraceptive hormones combined together can be a factor in increasing risk. Now, the point here is that the risk only applies if you're using contraceptive hormones for a contraceptive purpose in women with migraine with aura. And the reason for that is because there's lots of other methods of contraception that many of which are more effective than taking combined hormonal contraception, that are more effective for contraception. So why generate a risk, unnecessary risk, in a woman for contraceptive purposes when she doesn't need to? She can use a different contraceptive method that may be more effective. If we're specifically managing a medical disorder, so something like polycystic ovarian syndrome, something like endometriosis, something like menstrual migraine, it may then be appropriate in those women to use combined hormonal contraception, because for them, with the other medical issues, the benefits may outweigh that very small increased risk. So that's really why we see the difference.
And what if you, as you're determining those risks that are really attributed to migraine with aura to a greater extent, what if you don't know if you have migraine with aura at a certain stage of life? That, as we know, migraine changes over time. For me, when I was younger, it was very clear that I had migraine with aura. It's less clear to me, the aura piece of that is less clear to me. How do you determine what to use and balance that with risk of stroke as you are making these assessments about which way to proceed with hormone therapy?
That is such a good question, because it's not only you as an individual. I think healthcare providers often also get confused as to what actually constitutes an aura, which can lead to women being denied a method of contraception unnecessarily, because actually the symptoms they get aren't aura. And there is out there, there is a little bit of a fear of migraine if you're not feeling confident as to how to make a diagnosis. But all the risks have been attributed to typical migraine aura. So there are some other conditions like hemiplegic migraine, or you know, some other things which are a little bit more complicated, but it's the typical migraine aura that seems to drive the risks. So when we're looking for diagnosis, we're looking to diagnose typical migraine aura. And those who experience migraine aura, it is really obvious. You shouldn't be confused. So if you're confused, it's unlikely to be migraine aura, because it is so typical. And the way to be aware, quite often people will experience, or women will experience, migraine aura at times of these massive hormone fluctuations. We've talked about it at perimenopause, but the other time that it occurs is during the teenage years, or around the time of puberty, when migraine starts for the very first time, and we have hormone chaos then as well. And quite often young girls will say, I was standing on a beach and I was, so the sun was bright on the waves of the sea, and then I suddenly got this bright spot in my vision, and then I started getting these zigzaggy lines that started moving across my field of vision, and that lasted about 20 minutes and then it disappeared. And then after that, I got a headache, the sick headache. So that is classic migraine aura. The generalized spots in front of the eyes, the sensitivity to light that can last for several hours before the start of a migraine, continue through the migraine, those are premonitory symptoms, prodromes, they're not migraine aura. So three questions that we ask is, do you get visual disturbances? But more importantly than that, because you don't want to just pick up the premonitory irrelevant visual symptoms, how long do those symptoms last? So do those symptoms last less than an hour? Do they resolve before the onset of headache? Because again, that's typical migraine aura. And actually a fourth question that can be very useful is, do you still see them with your eyes shut? And the reason for that is because the aura is coming from the visual cortex at the back of the brain. It's not in the eyes. So if it's just the spots in front of the eyes, typical of prodromes, shut your eyes, they disappear. Whereas if it's migraine aura, you shut your eyes and you've still got these really bright zigzaggy lines that are still moving across your field of vision. And there's actually a really good YouTube clip, if I'm allowed to say so, which is Mayo Clinic Migraine Aura. And they have a beautiful depiction of this bright scintillating scotoma that moves across your field of vision. And it is just so classic that you shouldn't be uncertain.
That's very helpful and such an interesting distinction, the idea of testing this through closing your eyes and recognizing if it's present or not, and therefore where it's originating. Thank you for that. So recognizing the importance, obviously, of knowing whether you're dealing with migraine or migraine with aura and making some of these determinations, you then have, it sounds like, a number of different hormone approaches to choose from. You've mentioned MHT, HRT, or hormone therapy, as it may be referred to, depending on where in the world we lived. You've mentioned combined hormonal contraception. You've also talked about within those the options for what often is referred to as the bioidentical hormones. How do you determine which approach to take first with a perimenopausal or menopausal patient?
Yeah, it depends on where they are in their menopause transition, and it will probably change across time. So it'll also depend on what other symptoms that they are getting. So there is a difference between managing menstrual migraine from managing a perimenopausal woman with migraine, from managing a postmenopausal woman with migraine, because they will all have different needs and different symptoms. So menstrual migraine is really looking at where in the menopause transition might this person be? Do they have any menopause symptoms? Are their periods regular? Do they have any menstrual disorders that need to be managed? What is the most likely underlying mechanism? And so if they have heavy menstrual bleeding, we'll be looking at menstrual disorders management, which may well in itself manage the menstrual migraine. If they're having the migraine that's starting maybe a few days before the onset of the menstrual period, then it may likely be due to the drop in the estrogen levels. Many of these women during perimenopause or even just with menstrual migraine are actually needing contraception as well. Contraceptive hormones are probably a lot safer than many women realize and can have many benefits as well. And we're now also blessed that we do have some contraceptive hormones, certainly in the UK, that contain body identical estrogen, as is used in HRT, rather than the synthetic ethanol estradiol. And while even oral natural estrogens make your blood a little bit more sticky than the patches or gels or sprays that we can use for HRT, most women who are younger, unless they are very obese, they've got hypertension, they can actually safely take combined hormonal contraception till they're 50, and maybe a little bit longer if we're using it again for a medical indication rather than contraceptive. If we're then looking at perimenopausal women, again, it will depend on regularity of periods. They may be more likely to be developing hot flushes or night sweats. If they are experiencing relatively regular periods, then we're probably still having to think of suppressing the ovarian cycle rather than adding to hormone disruption with hormone replacement therapy. But as they transition further into menopause and postmenopause, again, if they have significant vasomotor symptoms, flushes or sweats, palpitations, anxiety, joint pains, all of those symptoms suggestive of menopause, then we are thinking control hot flushes and night sweats using standard menopause hormone therapy, and that can benefit the migraine as well. So it's a transition through depending on a woman's needs, her background.
Sure. Now, speaking to that latter category, do you then attempt to wean off those hormones at some point after menopause? I ask this because one of our viewers, Karen, shared her fear of coming off the hormones that she's been on for 10 years following a surgically induced menopause, and if doing so could negatively impact.
So this will depend on the reason why the woman is taking the hormone replacement. So here we're talking about hormone replacement therapy, the MHT, as opposed to contraceptive hormones, because contraceptive hormones, you don't need contraception beyond the age of 55. And the time between 50 and 55, we make adjustments depending on the individual woman. But if we're thinking about longer term hormone replacement therapy, if a woman has had a surgical menopause and her ovaries have been removed, we actually need to be thinking beyond migraine. We need to be thinking about the needs of that individual and not just quality of life, but things like her heart health and her bone health. Because she's not producing any estrogen, she's got no ovarian estrogen production. All of her estrogen will be coming from the outside. And particularly if she's using the non-oral forms of estrogen, such as patches or a gel or a spray, certainly these are the three modalities that we have in the UK, those really don't increase your risk of anything. So they don't make your blood more sticky at all over and above your background risk. And women who are using estrogen only hormone replacement therapy, estrogen does not appear to increase the risk of breast cancer. On the positive side, it benefits cardiac health, heart health. So it stops the blood vessels from furring up like a kettle, atherosclerosis, as we get older. And it also maintains a scaffolding within your bones, so keeping your bones strong and protecting against osteoporosis. So certainly for women who've had a surgical menopause in that way, the risks of stopping are greater than any potential risks of continuing, and the benefits of continuing far outweigh any potential risks. In women who still have their ovaries, again, it's back to the individual profile of that woman. But for many women, certainly within the UK, our guidance is very clear. There is no upper age limit for hormone replacement therapy. It really depends on the individual woman, and provided for her, the benefits of continuing outweigh any potential risks. And we have safer and safer HRT. So it's back down to that discussion with the healthcare provider and getting good, clear information about looking at one side, potential benefits of continuing, the other side, the potential risks of continuing, and looking at which outweighs which for you as a person.
In an individualized, highly individualized way.
Has to be,
Sure,
as
sure.
is migraine management as well.
Yes. Now, we often hear about the idea that the migraine brain doesn't like change, like stability in a lot of things, right? Sleep, et cetera. This seems like another important example of that as we're talking about hormone levels and how our migraine can react to fluctuations, as you've shared. And one of our viewers, Ruth, talked about how dramatic her migraine change was after removal of her ovaries, talked about how she seemingly became chronic overnight. Is this an example of a response to a drastic fluctuation?
Yes, it's not just that, it's how the whole brain is affected. So when we think about hormones, we often just think about our ovaries and we don't think about our brain. And estrogen is a very strong active hormone within the brain as well. The other thing within the brain is our hypothalamus. And our hypothalamus is where much of the migraine seems to emanate from. It's the master of our whole hormone orchestra, if you like. It regulates our menstrual cycle. It regulates our sleep patterns. It regulates our thirst. It regulates emotion. It's central. And it's also central to migraine. It's central to the drive of our menstrual cycle. So if we remove the ovaries, the brain is trying to look to send messages to ovaries that no longer exist. And so certainly temporarily, the brain goes into overdrive, it's lost its balance of things, and migraine will significantly worsen. If you do nothing, time will balance it all out. It will improve with time. But there is also the issue of surgical menopause. There are other health factors that may need to be managed depending on that individual person. And sometimes by immediately putting back the estrogen that the brain is looking for, if you like, in its postal way round, then that can actually benefit the individual. But it takes a little bit of time. Hormones always take roughly about 3 months to get themselves balanced back again. So nothing is going to benefit or change immediately. You have to be a little bit patient.
Well, I think that those of us living with migraine have certainly become accustomed to the idea of needing patience. So I guess this is one more example of where we need to call upon that. So many have been told that migraine will dramatically improve for a lot of people after menopause. Of course, we find that is not true for everyone, certainly, who lives with migraine. Are there any differences in the likelihood of realizing those improvements to migraine after menopause based on what your own history of migraine has been, whether it's been migraine with aura, migraine without aura, menstrual aura predominantly, that can give us any indication of our future with migraine?
But very definitely, yes. So migraine without aura that has linked to the hormone cycle that has improved during pregnancy, where we get not just stable estrogen levels, but a lot of other things go on that can benefit migraine during pregnancy. But removing the menstrual cycle at that time, seeing these strong increasing hormonal association during perimenopause, we know that in those women, the further years they are away from their last menstrual period, the greater the likelihood of improvement of their migraine without aura. In contrast, migraine with aura can often begin for the first time postmenopause and be a little bit more of a problem. It's less likely to improve. It seems to be a sort of completely different, have a different drive to it. But with the hormone migraine and postmenopause, there is this sort of sense of, oh, I've got to my last menstrual period and I'm going to get better. My migraine's going to get better now. Patience, again, I'm afraid, has to be considered at this time, because ovaries don't just suddenly switch off. Menopause is a marker for the ovaries no longer producing eggs, so no longer ovulating, but it's not a marker for ovarian activity. So your ovaries will still be active probably for about another 5 years after you've reached your last menstrual period, gradually becoming quieter and quieter and quieter, because they're still trying to respond to the messages from the brain telling them to create a menstrual cycle every month. So it takes a while for that activity to die down. But time can be the great healer for the hormonal headaches, but unfortunately not so much for those women in whom there's been no hormone association.
Another of our Migraine World Summit viewers, Amber, wonders if there are any herbal methods that help both with hormone balance and associated migraine.
Yes, a lot. And it's not just herbal methods. I should start off by lifestyle, diet, hydration, maintaining a healthy weight, exercise, those are all things that help both menopause symptoms and menopause migraine. And certainly for, you know, those women who can't take hormones, and one should be very clear that hormones don't benefit everybody, not everybody should have them. It's a conversation about what is right for the individual, but there's a lot that can be done, making sure that your brain gets the fuel that it needs. We're not very good at looking after our brains. We start thinking about our bodies, but less so about our brains. So don't fast if you're somebody who gets migraine. Our migraine brain does not like that. It likes a regular fuel supply, like just keeping the petrol running through the car engine. But going on to the answer to the specific questions about natural or herbal treatments, yes, Agnus castus can be a very effective herbal treatment. That's chaste berry. And we see that quite helpful for things like premenstrual syndrome. We've seen it sort of balance out a number of the perimenopause symptoms. And the correct dose of that, if anybody is interested, that's been shown in clinical trials is 20 milligrams. And that's equivalent to about 400 milligrams of the dried product. The other one that is also used for menopause symptoms as well as St. John's wort. So that acts on serotonin. Serotonin, interestingly, obviously we know that it's associated with migraine, but it's also the thing that drives the hot flushes. So it causes the blood vessels to constrict and dilate. And so serotonin is working in parallel with estrogen. So if you can't take estrogen or don't want to take estrogen, you act on the serotonin, and acting on the serotonin can also benefit migraine and menopause symptoms too.
So let's touch a little bit on where and with whom we can partner to attempt best to manage our migraine because of its immense burden in the Aids to Management of Headache Disorders in Primary Care in the Journal of Headache and Pain. You and your team highlighted the importance of migraine being well managed in primary care, with the exception of chronic migraine, which you note likely requires specialist management. What about hormonally related migraine? Can it effectively be managed at the primary care level? You've mentioned so much nuance to this that it makes me question.
Yeah, I think primary care physicians often know their patients better than we do in secondary care. And the thing is to enable them to have the tools to manage. And I think often they are getting much better at listening to their patients for that information as well. The thing about migraine, particularly managing hormone migraine, is it's crossing specialties. And so many people with migraine, they don't know whether to go to their gynecologist, they don't know whether to go to a neurologist. The neurologist will say, I don't know how to manage the hormones, and the gynecologist will say, I don't know how to manage the neurological aspects of this. The people who understand best often how to manage contraceptive methods, how to manage hormone replacement methods, are actually the physicians working in primary care. So we just need to enable them to be more confident in managing. It's them that the information needs to be provided with, the tools to know how to manage migraine and develop that confidence in managing migraine, because they're the ones that work cross-specialty. And unfortunately, the way that the medical systems work, you either get trained in gynecology or you get trained in neurology. And I've just been incredibly lucky in my own practice by just deciding I didn't care about having to train in one or the other. I just decided I want to work in both. And, you know, either people would accept me doing that or they won't, that I've managed to work across the field. And I think it's unlikely that we're going to get secondary care specialists trained in that way, because the structure just isn't such. So we are very much depending on providing our primary care partners with with those tools.
So you've studied potential genetic associations, for instance, with menstrual migraine. Could that type of research yield new treatments specifically for menstrual migraine or down the road, menopausal migraine?
Yes. Now, this we thought we were onto some quite useful links with genetics and, you know, some of the hormone sensitive genes. But unfortunately, with the larger studies, as we've got better, as genetic research has got better, and we're looking at the genome-wide studies, which is looking at large numbers of people rather than small populations, we actually haven't found any differences in the DNA, in the core DNA. I think it's much more likely, as is probably the case with migraine in general, as well as the hormonal migraine, that it's what we call epigenetic factors. So while our DNA never changes, our epigenetic factors do. And these are the modifications that occur in the way that our genes function, if you like. So while the genes don't change, what they do can change depending on the modifications from what we call epigenetics and those messages that are sent to them. And these are all the lifestyle things as much as anything else. This is, you know, lifestyle, exercise, diet, stress, hormone fluctuations. You know where I'm coming from, because they're all the same things that are actually involved in migraine process. And they change as we age as well. So I think rather than it being directly the genes, we need to be looking at the way our genes work and respond to the messages that are given to them. And that's a whole new field that's just beginning to really sort of kick off and will increase our understanding.
So not just what we're born into the world with, but how all of that interacts during our lifetimes in the world in which we end up living.
Yes, I think, you know, the thing that would really help move us forward with this would be twin studies, where you look at twins who've got exactly the same genetic code, but their experience and the diseases, the migraines they get can be very different. And that's epigenetics. Mm.
Dr. Lynn Griffiths offered a fantastic talk on epigenetics in 2022 with a lot of interesting information that underpins what you're mentioning here, too. So how else do you see hormonal management of migraine evolving over time?
Well, first of all, better identification of a problem. Better identification of migraine in the first place, because the most common misdiagnosis of migraine without aura is sinusitis. So particularly women who have been identified with having monthly sinusitis, we need to start thinking again. Simple diaries. So many women are not aware that they have this hormonal link because they haven't kept records. They don't link up the menstrual cycle with the migraine attacks that they are getting. And very simple diaries, just looking at patterns, can tell you a huge amount of what's going on. So better recognition, better treatment of migraine in itself. So it's important, although we've been talking about hormones, we've been talking about hormone treatment, the major thing is to make sure that the migraine attacks are being optimally treated, so that women treating their migraine attacks, they're taking the right dose, the right drug, at the right time. They're aware that particularly for hormonal migraine, they may need to take that treatment over several consecutive days, because, you know, triptan will wear off after 24 hours. And if you've got a 4-day migraine, you need to be repeating it. And that's not necessarily going to lead to medication overuse, because they may then not take anything for the next couple of weeks. So again, it's looking at the patterns of use, not just going in with, you know, you can't take it longer than 3 days. Look at what the individual is experiencing. So identifying the problem and looking outside the box and not just treating the migraine, but treating the woman with the migraine. So what are the other hormonal issues? What are the other problems that need to be managed? Particularly because certainly in my mind, I see migraine as a barometer, if you like, of a whole individual's general health, physical and emotional well-being. And the migraine fits into that. You can't compartmentalize migraine outside what else a woman is experiencing. From the hormone research perspective, we need to start looking at what happens with hormones in men. So we know, for example, that men who get migraine without aura, non-obese men, that they tend to run higher estrogen levels than men, non-obese men who don't get migraine. So looking at that factor. Transgender, we know that male to female transgender, when they start taking estrogen, they go from male migraine prevalence to female migraine prevalence. So this isn't anything to do with menstrual migraine, because obviously transgender male to female don't menstruate, but their migraine prevalence increases once they start taking estrogen. We need animal studies in female animals. So all the animal studies are done to date, mostly in male mice models or rodent models, because they don't have to worry about the hormone changes affecting the studies that they are doing. And that's obviously not going to benefit us looking at how the changing hormone environment affects the migraine models in those studies. And I'm pleased to know that a number of research groups are beginning to look at that. We also need to start working much more cross-specialty as well, and making a noise about managing migraine. You know, certainly in the UK, we've seen some really good sort of social media drives that have raised the profile of managing menopause. We need to do the same with migraine. We can't keep talking about, as I was, just about educating the primary care physicians. We need to get the people with the problem, the women with the problem, to shout out loudly, because that's the only way that we're going to drive and force a change at the other end, as has happened with menopause here.
What a great reminder to so many of us to remember our potential as advocates. So are there any resources that you'd like to point any of our viewers to on the topic of managing hormones in treating migraine?
For women, there is a website called Women's Health Concern. And just Googling Women's Health Concern, it comes up, and it's got some really useful fact sheets, including migraine and menopause and HRT. It's also got about contraception. It's got lots of fact sheets on women's health problems as well. For healthcare professionals, we have the British Menopause Society guidelines as well. Those are available to healthcare professionals. And they also, there is one on migraine and menopause. There's also lots of publications that I've written that if people go to my website, www.annemcgregor.com, and they go to publications, that link straight to my ResearchGate page, which has a list of all the publications, many of which people can directly access.
We've learned so much today about the topic of hormones, their role in migraine, and how to approach hormone therapy in managing migraine at various stages of our lives. Thank you so much, Dr. McGregor, for sharing your time and expertise on this topic.
You're very welcome. Thank you.